This podcast is sponsored by QCon AI, the Applied AI Conference for Software Developers. Focusing on the practices of artificial intelligence and machine learning, QCon AI takes a different tack than most other major software conferences in the AI ML space today. Rather than focusing on data scientists, QCon AI targets how full-stack software engineers can apply machine learning and AI techniques in their day-to-day roles. QCon AI takes place in San Francisco, April 9th through 11th, 2018. You can find out more about the conference online at qcon.ai.
Welcome to the InfoQ podcast, a software engineering podcast from the people behind InfoQ.com. I'm Charles Humble, InfoQ's editor-in-chief, and I'm joined today by Eric Horsney. Eric was a founding team member at Internet Way, which was a French B2B company. He then founded Radiance, which was a global finance cloud, which he sold to BT. And he is now the CEO of StreamData.io. He has a background in high-frequency trading. He spoke at QCon London a couple of weeks ago on my track, and I very much enjoyed his talk, and I'm thrilled that he's come along to do a podcast with us. So, Eric, welcome to the InfoQ podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles, and hello, everybody.
So tell me about StreamData.io. What was it built for, and who are your customers?
So it was built for developers that were facing the issue of having to present real-time data to applications and web clients, especially in the trading area. And our customers are typically banks, brokers, and API providers. We provide a proxy as a service, and we listen to APIs, and we turn those APIs into event-driven data feeds.
So were you building the product for banks and brokers initially? Was that the original idea?
Those customers, yes, right away. And actually, we built the product for them, and they were our early adopters. We actually were suffering when working with some of them integrating external data feeds. We were suffering from the challenge of presenting dynamic data onto applications, and we built the product to actually relieve our own pain. So that was expected. The latest development were not expected.
So who is that? Sort of hedge funds and people like that?
Exactly. What's happened last year is that we've seen hedge funds and servers of artificial intelligence companies using our service to listen to APIs that we wouldn't have thought about. And that's the main motivation why I came to London to talk about what was going on right now in hedge funds.
Okay, so the hedge funds have been using, well, I'm not sure if it's AI as such, but they've been using mathematicals of various kinds for a long time. I mean, since the early 1980s, I guess. I think in your talk you mentioned Renaissance Technologies, for example, who've been specialists in sort of systemic quantitative trading for some time. So it's not overly surprising in a way, but I guess the sort of AI part of that feels quite new, or at least it does to me. Is that a reasonable summary?
Artificial intelligence in itself is a pretty old concept, and finance has been using it for a while, some better than others. And I would tend to think that Renaissance Technologies have always been the best in that area. And that's because of their choice of hiring mathematics and physicians background rather than financial backgrounds. So that was not at their beginning deep learning, because those concepts didn't exist, but the concepts they used from the beginning based on the kind of people they hired was definitely artificial intelligence to make sense out of the market, and that was 40 years ago. Now, what I think has changed is the evolution in and maturation of artificial intelligence with deep learning, with a systematic and professional or very deep way of applying artificial intelligence to markets and to systems in general. I think a lot of those programs were made for weather forecasts. You know, the weather forecast has improved a lot over the past 20 years. It's not yet perfect, but we can tell that it's definitely on the seven day forecast way better than it used to be 20 years ago. So on that basis, and also for linguistic and image recognition, a lot of progress have been made thanks to Google, Facebook, and others investing a lot on making progress there.
Right. So, in terms of the hedge funds, we're presumably talking about sort of neural networks and deep learning being applied now to that field as well. If I've got that correct.
Yes. Exactly. The frameworks and recipes that have been created for weather forecast and other day-to-day activities can be used for financial decision making in the market. So you can actually represent the market the same way you represent planets. So you put you take the planet Earth and you divide it in cubes of 10 kilometers to build a model and build a weather forecasting model. That's the way it works. You can pretty much do the same thing with the economy and add some equation that are different, but ultimately get to a prediction on the same basis.
Great. Okay, thank you. So let's try and unpack that a little bit. If we're training a neural network for a trading system, what are the kind of techniques that you're using to do that training?
So it depends on the time horizon you give yourself for your strategy. If you have a 1 hour time horizon, then you can pretty much use all the techniques of deep learning. And that comes with things that have made huge progress in neural networks based on gradient descent, like backpropagation. And these are techniques that come with some recipes and some discipline, like learning, testing, and validating. This is the classic deep learning use when you can make decision every hour, because it takes quite some time to consume lots of data, and the more data you consume, the better is going to be your prediction. Now, if you want to have an impact on the market every minute or every second, these models are more difficult to apply.
Okay. So in data science and AI generally, there's a very common problem with overfitting. And I'm imagining that you can have the same problem with a neural net that you've trained, in the sense that the market changes or can change very quickly. So this is a classic switching from bullish to bearish type thing that can happen unexpectedly quickly. Is that a significant problem in this context, if you've trained your model, say, with a bullish data set and then the market switches on you?
Yeah. And that's the main reason why there are limitations in using deep and broad data sets to make your decision, because if you make a decision and the market has changed mood, then you're going to make wrong decisions. So if we think about your machine learning as a brain, if you train the brain of your machine with a data set that came from a market that was bullish, then the brain will learn that when market moves up, it is a smart thing to have a look at it and probably invest before others, so that you want to follow momentum this way and anticipate momentum. Then if you start having this brain applying the same logic to a market that has turned in just 1 hour into a bearish market on some of the instruments that the brain has decided to trade upon, then you're going to be hitting some failure.
Because
the brain will start over-investing in a market that's become scarce and where it is very risky with lots of embouchure. So you don't want to do that. And vice versa. If you've trained your brain in a very tough market where it is there's a lot of risk and you don't want to take any of it, and you have to wait a lot before taking positions because you don't really know where you stand in terms of a landscape, it's a gloomy area, then when market turns into bearish, you're not going to invest enough and you will be behind everybody else. So that's a classic issue with overfitting. It's when you've trained the brain to something that was specific to some time and some environment, and the brain got fit to that environment so much that it cannot be performant to another environment.
So how do you avoid that?
So typically in AI, what you do to avoid that is to introduce some noise in the test data set that you put into your machine learning. So that's one way of doing it. But the issue when you introduce noise is that you end up having a brain that may not be fit for any market.
The other thing that I find interesting about this is that the traditional way of training models is quite time-consuming and slow, or at least I think of it as being quite time-consuming. So you take a data set and essentially you're doing a kind of batch training exercise, and then you're trying to test and validate that before you put it live. And it's surprising to me that that sort of approach would work in a financial situation, because the market can switch and change relatively quickly. Is that a problem? And if so, are there different ways that you can train models that maybe I'm not familiar with?
Yes, there is a different way. Different way is to have the model be trained on a subset of data with a time horizon and a window that actually evolves based on the time you're targeting, time horizon you're targeting. And the model will be able to adapt to the market and make decisions very quickly on the fly. So that's called streaming. That's data stream algorithms. And that's the one we presented with Albert of MOA or SAMOA from Apache. So that's one way. But again, if your machine learning and your investment strategy is long term or okay with making a decision once a day, then that's not an issue you have. I think the issue only comes when you start getting into strategies where you're pretty close to the market and you want to leverage momentum.
That makes total sense. Thank you. So I want to change tack a little bit now. And given your background in high-frequency trading, HFT, I wanted to talk a little bit about that as well. So could you maybe start by describing the buy-side industry for people who aren't familiar with it?
The buy-side industry is the group of companies that everybody know, like Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, Capgroup, BlackRock, who actually take money from people and invest it on the long term so that people can actually draw that money when they retire. It's a huge industry. It's in the U.S., it's 3 year of GDP of the U.S., $100 trillion. So a lot of money and long-term investments.
And the other side of that, I think, again, a lot of people's mental model is kind of, you know, from old films and things of traders sort of standing there shouting at each other across the trading floor. And it's presumably mostly algorithms at this point. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, the human trader is an exception in the market now.
Right. And then the second thing that we had was the rise of electronic exchanges. So I'm thinking of people like Brut and so on that were part of that set of regulatory changes that we had, the Cambian explosion, so-called. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, so in the US between 98 and 2005, we had an explosion of regulation as well, with regulation ATS, regulation NMS, to actually open the market, to let the opportunity for new players to come in and make the market more efficient electronically. So the new players were called ECNs, like INET, Brute, and then BATS, or Archipelago. And that led for the traders, or let's say the sell side, well, typically companies that service the buy side, that led for them to have to connect to all of these and make the right decisions based on the existence of all these markets. So they, instead of having to work with 2-3 markets, they had to work with 12.
Right. And you were mainly working on the kind of infrastructure side of this, correct?
Yeah.
You weren't writing algorithms so much, but you were dealing with the infrastructure side. So if HFT is mainly about reducing latency, what are the things that you can do from an infrastructure point of view to reduce latency?
You can work with the all the elements of what makes latency. One is the propagation time, which is the time it takes for the light to go from one point to another. And that depends on the distance, also depends on the density of the medium you use. Another element is the serialization, which is the time it takes for a data packet to be put on the medium. And to play with this, it's just a matter of using big pipes. If you have a 1 gig pipe, it's going to be 1,000 times faster than putting data on 1 meg pipe. And finally, there is a third element of latency, that is processing time. Anytime you have an equipment that is active, that is listening to the data and then routing it or filtering it or repeating it, it will take latency. So as long as you can remove equipment, you're going to be faster.
Okay, so let's go into each of those in turn then. So you mentioned propagation first, which is either locating yourself closer to the exchange or things like dark fiber, I guess, would be in there, and straight fiber as well. Can you talk about those a bit?
So on the what we saw happening in the year 2000 was that companies would start first getting as close as possible to exchanges, and that's why they wanted for my previous company Radiance to host them. And then they started to ask for dark fiber, which was a way for them to connect directly from one point to another with a minimal distance in terms of a fiber circuit between two points. So it was a straight fiber to win, like, for example, 3 milliseconds between Chicago and New York. And the funny part, I think, is after those trenches were built for the direct Chicago-New York, some guys came in with a very smart idea of using old radio waves towers to actually leverage the density of air that is lower than the density of glass, so that the speed of light in the air is 40% better and faster. And they could win another 3 milliseconds, so that the trenches were no longer the best thing to do, even though millions had been spent into them. So coming back to old, you know, radio waves was actually the smarter move to be faster than others.
Oh, it's amazing, actually, isn't it? It's just the idea that you can kind of switch the medium and gain another 3 or 4 milliseconds is kind of astonishing to me.
It is.
And then you mentioned serialization as well. So what kind of things are people playing with in terms of speeding that aspect up?
So that one is the usual size of the pipe you use between one point and another. So if you go from so at that time, let's say the typical media was a 10 meg, and then it went into 100 meg, or with ATM 155 meg. if you go from 100 meg to 1 gig or 10 gig, then you can reduce your latency by a few milliseconds as well.
Right. Yep. Okay. And then the third aspect that you talked about was processing, which seems to be quite a battleground going on, I think, at the moment with FPGA and the like.
Yeah. The processing is very well understood to all developers. There are two things. The first thing is to avoid to cross equipment. So it's equipment avoidance by going direct from one point to another. And the second thing is whenever you actually need to heat an equipment, like a feed handler, that is an equipment that's going to be used to translate the exchange feed into something that your algo can reuse, you can actually accelerate that processing time by building dedicated circuit for your feed. So you have companies like Nova Sparks today that are very good at creating circuits dedicated to feed handlers that will give you a few nanoseconds or microseconds advantage against your competition.
I just find that, I really do find that astonishing that we're at the point where we're building custom hardware to try and keep kind of one level ahead of the competition. I find that extraordinary. Do you see the same thing on the hedge fund side, on the AI side, with so GPUs are obviously very kind of well known for this kind of thing. So presumably exactly. You've got hedge funds investing heavily in GPUs as well.
Actually, I guess everybody today working or using AI is using GPU, whether they know it or not. I do not know, but I may just be ignorant. I do not know of a specific GPU for hedge funds yet. But just using GPU, they are so powerful to perform calculus computation on derivatives metrics. Which is exactly what you need for gradient descent and backpropagation. They're so good at it that you can leverage them even today. If you're a customer of Google or if you're a customer of probably all the other clouds, you're going to use GPU as part of their AI offering.
So how much of this sort of work is being done in the cloud versus in their own kind of data centers? I tend to think of these companies as being quite conservative about kind of exporting data off site. Is that still the case or has that changed?
Conservative, yes, for a good reason, because it's we're talking about intellectual property that generates a lot of money. Especially if you're good at it. So whether even if it costs more not to host with a third party and host within a data center that you master end-to-end, the return on your risk will be probably better today. Now, I would think that some elements can be put in the cloud.
Right, okay. And in terms of stream data itself, what's kind of next for you? What are the things that are working on? What are the things that you're excited about?
So we're gonna get closer to Greenwich and Stanford, where hedge funds are. I think what's exciting for us is the idea of servicing one more AI companies on top of the application. Builder that were using us for presenting real-time data. What we're exploring right now are sectors other than finance using real-time data, including transport and healthcare. So yeah, tons of stuff, too much stuff.
That's very, very exciting. One more question, I think. So that going back to the hedge funds, what are the kind of data sources that you're using? It's not purely market data, I'm assuming. You're
No.
presumably going wider than that to try and get ahead of the curve in some way.
So it's not Stream Data using them, but Stream Data offering the possibility for people to build these brains. So let's say you have a totally event-driven brain, which is classic now. You have a Kafka belt, and you're using a streaming algorithm that's totally event-driven with a complex event processing as starter. What you want is that that brain be fed with as much information as possible about the world surrounding it. So definitely you need some market data. So you can use XIgnite and other event-driven cloud providers for market data. You also need to consume data about what people say about companies that you can find on social networks like Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn for corporate data. And then you also have networks like StatWits specialized in social trading data with people that are experts in the area and will start commenting about what they think about a specific company at a specific time. You can also consume APIs specialized in providing you a sentiment on specific instruments, and there are like people like Vitar, SiteSignal, Optimize specialized in it. So with that, your brain will start having a good feel of what people think about what's going on in the market, so that the brain can actually make educated decision as if it was on the floor of all exchanges and sitting by all the analysts and traders in the world having their feelings about the market. So that brain will actually be smarter than anybody else. Now, what's going on right now is that you can start seeing people consuming unusual data like retail data for forecast. Like if you want to forecast the sales of a plastic manufacturer, it is probably a good idea of looking at how many handbags are being sold in China today. Or if you're trading on meat in Chicago, meat futures, of course, it's probably a good idea to listen to what's going on in Argentina on IoT sensors that are being used to check the health of cows in Argentina. So these unusual sources of data are actually opening wealth of possibilities for the brain to actually know everything that's happening at a given moment in the world to make the best possible decision on whether or not it should buy or sell a specific instrument.
So that's completely fascinating. So you've got a real mix of sort of sentiment analysis stuff and natural language processing and data from sensors and all sorts of things coming in. It's really, really intriguing.
Oh, it is. And took me a while to actually understand what was going on.
I'm not surprised. And as it's an interesting contrast to HFT as well, because with HFT it's essentially raw speed, isn't it? It's kind of it always feels like a bit of an arms race that it's just who's got the, who's got the fastest, who's closest to the exchange, and so on. Whereas this is much more of a kind of computer science problem in the traditional sense of it. I think it's really, really interesting stuff.
It's let's say 10 years ago when we were Flash Boys, that was all about speed and being faster, which was fun for ops people for like us. Now today, it's more about knowing more than others every second, and your edge is not on speed. Your edge is on how fast you can make sense of how much data and what is your ability to build a model that's going to be smart enough to make sense out of some data that could seem uncorrelated.
Right, that's brilliant. Eric, I could talk to you for hours, I think. That's been really, really interesting. Thank you so much for making the time today. And just thank you very much indeed for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Charles.
You've been listening to the InfoQ podcast, a podcast from the people behind InfoQ.com.
Show notes from this and all the other episodes that we've recorded are available on infoq.com/podcast. You can subscribe to the InfoQ podcast on iTunes. We also do a culture-oriented podcast called With No Prizes for Originality, the InfoQ Culture Podcast. You can find that on InfoQ as well. Eric Horsney's presentation from QCon London will be published on the site shortly, so look out for that. And he is speaking soon at Jack's Finance in London. That's at the beginning of April. Thank you for listening.